From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
Medical apartheid is a story of the disproportionate use of African Americans in abusive, non-therapeutic medical research. In the book, I trace this phenomenon from the colonial time to the present day.
The dark history of medical experimentation on Black Americans from colonial times to the present. We'll speak with author Harriet Washington about her new book, Medical Apartheid. But first, the Senate takes on Alberto Gonzalez.
And it is easy for us to sit here comfortably in this room, knowing that we're not going to be sent off to another country to be tortured, to treat it as though, well, Attorney General Ashcroft said, we got assurances.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. A successful anti-satellite test by China is raising fears of renewed arms race in space. The test was carried out last week, the first known attempt in two decades. Chinese missiles targeted a weather satellite just over 500 miles from Earth, creating a cloud of debris that'll take years to clear. Some experts believe China conducted the test to pressure the Bush administration into negotiating a weapons ban. The White House has rejected calls from Russia and China for an arms control treaty. Domestic spying was a top issue on Capitol Hill Thursday, one day after the Bush administration announced it'll finally seek court warrants for spying on U.S. citizens. The reversal comes more than 5 years after the Bush administration began the warrantless eavesdropping, and a little over a year after the program was first publicly disclosed. Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez appeared before the Senate Judiciary Committee to explain the delay. He was questioned by Republican Senator Arlen Specter.
I believe that the United States and the administration have paid a heavy price for not acting sooner to bring the terrorist surveillance program under judicial review. That's the traditional way before there is a wiretap or a search and seizure, to have probable cause established and to have court approval.
Critics have argued the Bush administration reversed its stance on domestic spying just as the Democrat-controlled Congress was to bring new scrutiny. Gonzalez says the administration had good reason for the delay.
I must take issue with Senator Specter. This is a very complicated application. In many ways, it's innovative in terms of the orders granted by the judge. It's not the kind of thing you just pull off the shelf. We worked on it a long time.
Gonzalez also said he will likely block the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court from disclosing details of the new orders authorizing the government spying. U.S. District Judge Colleen Calarcatelli says she has no objection to releasing the material to Congress, but that the Justice Department holds final say. Democratic Senator Russ Feingold also spoke.
It is an important moment in the history of our Constitution that this program has now been terminated and is now within the FISA statute, and I do hope that we recognize the importance of it in terms of our constitutional history.
News of the wiretap reversal coincided with an announcement telecom giant AT&T is facing an effort by shareholders to disclose its role in domestic spying. The shareholders have put forward a proposal asking AT&T executives to issue a report detailing its cooperation with the National Security Agency and outlining new steps to protect consumer privacy. The effort's being led by the investor activist group As You Sow. AT&T has asked the Securities and Exchange Commission to exclude the resolution from its proxy statement based partly on so-called state secret privilege. Back on Capitol Hill, Democrats completed their 100 hours agenda in the House Thursday with a measure repealing nearly $14 billion in tax breaks and subsidies to oil companies. Meanwhile, the Senate overwhelmingly approved an ethics bill aimed at curbing the role of lobbyists. The measure would ban lobby-funded gifts, meals, and travel, and force lawmakers to attach their names to special earmarks they insert into bills. In Iraq, U.S. and Iraqi forces have arrested a top aide to the Shia cleric Muqtada al-Sadr. The move comes ahead of a planned crackdown expected to target Baghdad's armed Shiite groups. Iraqi Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki has renewed accusations the Bush administration is under-equipping the Iraqi military. On Thursday, Maliki said there would be far less need for U.S. troops if the administration carried through on promises to equip the Iraqi forces. Maliki's appeared to be responding to Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice's recent public warning his government is living on, quote, borrowed time. Meanwhile, Iraqi President Jalal Talabani was in Damascus Thursday for a landmark meeting with Syrian President Bashar al-Assad. Talabani said Syria is taking steps to block foreign fighters from crossing into Iraq. Talabani was also asked about the Bush administration's plan to send more troops to Iraq.
I don't know how they are thinking. It's up to them to decide. We didn't ask more troops. But if they send more troops, they are welcomed.
Meanwhile, in Baghdad, Iran's ambassador to Iraq says he's received assurances five Iranians captured in a U.S. raid last week will be released. The five worked in Iran's consular office in the Iraqi city of Erbil. In other Iraq news, a U.S. soldier has agreed to plead guilty in the rape of an Iraqi teenager and the murder of her and her family by U.S. troops in the town of Mahmoudia. The soldier, Sergeant Paul Cortez, will avoid the death sentence. He's agreed to testify against three other soldiers accused in the rape and murder of 14-year-old Abir Qasim Hamza al-Janabi and the killing of her parents and her 5-year-old sister last March. In the occupied territories, dozens of Israeli peace activists were prevented from reaching the West Bank town of Hebron Thursday in a protest against Israeli settlements there. Yossi Belin, head of Israeli party Meretz, was among the protesters.
I think that we Israelis who believe in peace, who believe in two-state solution, cannot tolerate anymore the situation in Hebron, which is the worst in the territories. I think that what the world should know and Israelis should know that not every Israeli is an Israeli Hebronite. Not every Zionist believes that what we have to do is to prevent the Palestinians from living peaceful life. And that the settlement in Hebron should end. Jews should not live there.
Back in the United States, the Justice Department is close to authorizing a plan that would add the DNA of tens of thousands of people to a crime-fighting database maintained by the FBI. These include immigration violators, detainees in the so-called War on Terror, and others accused but not convicted of crimes. The American Civil Liberties Union is warning the plan is so broad it could apply to passengers screened at airports or hikers stopped in public parks. In Texas, DNA testing has exonerated a man convicted of child rape more than 25 years ago. The man, James Waller, is the 12th person to have a conviction overturned by DNA testing in the Dallas area since 2001. The Pentagon has drafted new rules for upcoming trials of prisoners at Guantanamo Bay that would allow convictions based on hearsay evidence and coerced testimony. The rules are part of a new manual drafted out of the Military Commissions Act passed by Congress last year. In Kenya, thousands, tens of thousands of people are gathering for the 7th edition of the World Social Forum. Organizers have billed this year's theme as, quote, people's struggles, people's alternatives, another world is possible. The World Social Forum kicks off tomorrow in Nairobi. And finally, the columnist Art Buchwald has died. Buchwald wrote Pulitzer Prize-winning humor columns for more than 50 years. This is Art Buchwald in 1967, care of the Pacifica Radio Archives.
One of the things I've discovered, particularly in the smaller towns, is they have four or five organizations to fight communists, but they don't have any communists. For example, I was in Sarasota, Florida, and the nearest card-holding communist was in Miami. And Miami wouldn't let him go. So they called up Jacksonville, and Jacksonville said, we need all we've got. So I've called for a redistribution of the Communist Party. It's called Busakami. So each town would get one. And he'd be the resident communist. And he'd be paid by the town to be the threat there.
Art Buchwald was 81 years old. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
and welcome to all of our viewers and listeners around the country and around the world.
Juan, before we go to the Senate to talk about Gonzalez being confronted, the attorney general, by the Senate, you wrote an interesting piece in the New York Daily News today.
So I reported that the Salvation Army, which is the largest, second largest charity in America, they have about $8 billion in reserves, moved this week to evict close to 200 women in New York City who are residents of buildings that they own because they want to cash in on the sizzling Manhattan real estate market and sell both buildings. I think they can get up to about $100 million apiece. So they have been systematically trying to get elderly and single women, that most of them low income, who have been living for decades, many of them in two buildings that the Salvation Army runs, and they have been moving to get them out. There are about 200 women who so far have not moved, and so on Wednesday night, they came with lawyers, with video cameras, and knocked on the doors of each one of them, handed them 30-day notices to get out, and then filmed the women receiving the notices. They are now attempting to get all 200 that are remaining still out. And it's amazing, when I talked to the Salvation Army and asked them about this, they said that they have a problem that a few years ago they received a $1.5 billion donation. That's a billion. From Joan Kroc, the widow of the McDonald's founder. But they have to build 25 community centers across the country with this money, and they need some extra money to be able to operate the center. So that's why they decided to sell these buildings and move all of these women out. So we'll see what happens. There's going to be a legal complaint filed this week against them, attempt to stop them. But
the women are organizing?
Yes, and they have Manhattan Legal Services is representing them. So we'll see what happens in the end. Well, now the Bush administration's handling of the case of Maher Arar came under new scrutiny Thursday when Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez appeared before the Senate Judiciary Committee, now controlled by the Democrats. Arar is the Canadian citizen who was seized by U.S. officials during a stopover flight in New York in 2002. He was secretly sent to Syria as part of the Bush administration's extraordinary rendition program. In Syria, Arar was held for almost a year in a grave-like cell. He was repeatedly tortured. He was released without ever being charged with a crime.
Last year, the Canadian government determined Maher Arar was innocent, but the Bush administration has never apologized for its actions. On Thursday, Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez refused to state why the U.S. detained him and why he was sent to Syria instead of home to Canada. The attorney general was questioned by Vermont Senator Patrick Leahy, now the new chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee.
Attorney General, I'm sorry. I don't mean treat this lightly. We knew damn well if he went to Canada, he wouldn't be tortured. He'd be held, he'd be investigated. We also knew damn well if he went to Syria, he'd be tortured. And it's beneath the dignity of this country, a country that has always been a beacon of human rights, to send somebody to another country to be tortured. You know, and I know, that has happened a number of times in the past 5 years by this country. It is a black mark on us. It has brought about the condemnation of some of our closest and best allies. They have made those comments both publicly and privately to the President of the United States and others. And it is easy for us to sit here comfortably in this room, knowing that we're not going to be sent off to another country to be tortured, to treat it as though, well, Attorney General Ashcroft said, we got assurances. Those assurances from a country that we also say now, oh, we can't talk to them because we can't take their word for anything.
Well, Senator, I'm
somewhat upset.
Yes, sir, I can tell. But before you get more upset, perhaps you should wait to receive the briefing.
How long?
I'm hoping that we can get the information next week.
Well, Attorney General, I'll tell you what I'll do. I'll meet you halfway on this. I'll wait next week for that briefing. If we don't get it, I guarantee you there'll be another hearing on this issue. Canadians have been our closest allies, longest unguarded frontier in the world. They're justifiably upset. They're wondering what's happened to us. They're wondering what's happened to us. Now, you know and I know, we're a country with a great, great tradition of protecting people's individual liberties and rights. You take an oath of office to do that. I take an oath of office to do that. I believe in my basic core nature in that.
Senator Patrick Leahy questioning Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez. Maher Arar is still awaiting an apology from the Bush administration. 3 months ago, Arar was honored in Washington, D.C. by the Institute for Policy Studies, but he was unable to attend the ceremony because he remains on the U.S. no-fly list, even though the Canadian government has publicly acknowledged he is innocent. This is part of a video message Maher Arar recorded for the award ceremony.
We now know that my story is not a unique one. Over the past 2 years, we have heard from many other people who have been kidnapped, unlawfully detained, tortured, and eventually released without being charged with any crime in any country. My nightmare began on September 26, 2002. I was transiting through New York Airport, JFK Airport, when they asked me to wait in a waiting area. I found that to be strange. Shortly after, some FBI officials came to see me, and they asked me whether I was willing to be interviewed. My first and immediate reaction was to ask for a lawyer, and I was surprised when they told me that I had no right to a lawyer because I was not an American citizen. Eventually, on October 8th, against my will, they took me out of my cell. They basically read a piece of document to me saying that we will be sending you to Syria. And when I complained, I said to them, I did explain to you that if I'm sent back, I will be tortured.
Maher Arar sent that video message when he was being honored by the Institute for Policy Studies in Washington, D.C. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
Well, a new report by the American Cancer Society shows that African Americans are still more likely than any other group to develop and die of cancer. The study states that the socioeconomic factors play the largest role in this disparity. African Americans have less access to health care and information and are less likely to get screening and medical treatment. Well, a new book offers one answer into why Black Americans deeply mistrust American medicine. Medical Apartheid, the Dark History of Medical Experimentation on Black Americans from Colonial Times to the Present, is the first and only comprehensive history of medical experimentation, abuse, and neglect of African Americans. The book reveals the hidden underbelly of scientific research and the roots of the African American health deficit. It begins with the earliest encounters of Blacks in the medical establishment during slavery, looks at how eugenics and social Darwinism were used to justify medical experiments conducted by the government and the military, and offers new details about the infamous Tuskegee experiments that began in the 1930s.
Medical Apartheid also examines less well-known abuses and looks at unethical practices and mistreatment of African Americans that are still taking place in the medical establishment today. We're joined now by the author of the book, Harriet Washington, a medical writer and editor, a visiting scholar at DePaul University School of Law. We welcome you to Democracy Now!
Thank you. I'm very happy to be here.
Well, this is a fascinating book. First of all, why did you take it on?
I took it on for two reasons. One, I'm a very naturally curious person, and when I was still a pre-medical undergraduate at the University of Rochester, I was working in a hospital and came across some case files that dramatically showed a disparity, a racial disparity, in people who were slated to receive kidneys. And that piqued my curiosity.
What do you mean?
Well, I came across some old case files in a forgotten file folder. And one was of a Black gentleman, one was of a white gentleman. The white gentleman's file was thick and full of testaments to his loving family, his insurance support, his determination to live, and detailed really Herculean attempts on the part of medical personnel to procure a kidney for him, kidney transportation still being relatively new then. The file of the Black gentleman was very thin. The word Negro appeared on every page of it, and somebody had underlined it on his social profile right above the single line that indicated that the medical staff's plans for him were to help him to prepare for his imminent demise. The white gentleman and the Black gentleman were very similar in their profiles, but they were treated differently. And I wanted to know whether this was a consistent feature of medical care, just an anomaly. And as I began looking into it, I just became intrigued in the vast differences in the way African Americans were used from research.
But your book doesn't just deal with modern times, but you go back into the beginning of the country and exactly how these kinds of disparities began to manifest themselves. Could you talk to us a little bit about those early years, especially during the period of slavery?
Right. The early years was quite chilling. First of all, it's important to understand that there was a scientific animus called scientific racism, which at that time was simply science. And it posited that black people were very, very different from whites, medically and biologically. And this provided a rationale and an underpinning not only for the institution of slavery. Slavery probably could not have persisted if there hadn't been this medical underpinning, but also for the use of blacks in research. For example, it said that blacks were less intelligent, subhuman, perhaps not even quite human, that they didn't experience pain, that they were immune to diseases like malaria and heat sickness that made it impossible for whites to work in the field, but made them perfect for labor in the field. So this set of beliefs, a set of scientific beliefs, was not buttressed by any real data, but only by the needs of the community. And this actually gave permission for doctors to acquire slaves for research. They also had a variety of conditions for which a good example is reproductive health. All of the early important reproductive health advances were devised by perfecting experiments on black women. Why? Because white women could say no. White women were not interested in having doctors looking at their genitalia during the Victorian era, and white women were not interested in undergoing painful surgery without anesthesia, but black women could not say no. So this animus began, as you say, in the very early days of our republic, and it simply snowballed until by the time of the Civil War, blacks were being used almost exclusively in some venues and in very high proportions in others for everything, vaccine design, experimental surgeries, and they were never consensual. You never asked their permission, and rarely were they therapeutic. They were mostly to expand medical knowledge.
We have to go to break. When we come back, I want to ask you about the Tuskegee experiment, which a lot of people know about, but you say actually the emphasis on that obscures a lot of other experimentation that has gone on over the last centuries. We are talking to Harriet Washington. She's author of the book Medical Apartheid. We'll be back in a minute.
I knew how it would feel to be free. I wish I could break all the chains holding me. I wish I could say all the things that I should say. Say them loud, say them clear for the whole round world to hear. I wish I could share all the love that's in my heart. Remove all the bars that keep us apart. I wish you could know what it means to be me.
I wish I knew how it feels to be free. The late Nina Simone. Here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. We're talking to Harriet Washington, who's written a quite remarkable book called Medical Apartheid. She's a medical writer and editor, visiting scholar at DePaul University School of Law, previously a fellow in medical ethics at Harvard Medical School, wrote for USA Today, and also was a Knight Fellow at Stanford University. Juan?
Yeah, before we come up to modern times, I'd like to get back to the slavery period. And in your book, you talk about you document specific examples of some of the doctors who were involved in these ghoulish experiments. So you mentioned Dr. James Marion Sims and Dr. Walter F. Jones. Could you talk about some of the things that they practiced on slaves in those days?
Right. James Marion Sims was a very important surgeon from Alabama, and all of his medical experimentation took place with slaves. He took the skulls of young children, young black children, only black children, and he opened their heads and moved around the bones of the skull to see what would happen. Posited as a cure for disease, but there was no rationale for that. He also decided to remove the jawbone of a slave, but this slave was pretty intractable. He did not want the surgery. He loudly protested against it, and in response, Dr. Sims had him tied to a barber's chair and held immobile while he operated on him without anesthesia. But he's most infamous for his experiments, reproductive experiments with black women. He bought or otherwise acquired a group of black women who he housed in a laboratory, and over the period of 5 years and approximately 40 surgeries on one slave alone, he sought to cure a devastating complication of childbirth called vesicovaginal fistula. This cure entailed repeatedly doing incisions on their genitalia. Very painful and, you know, very emotionally difficult, as you can imagine. And in the end, he claims to have cured one of them. And after this, he went north, where his medical fortune was made. He became the toast of Second Empire Paris when he went there to be the personal physician of Princess Eugenie. And when he returned to New York, he was elected the president of the American Medical Association. I think this is really important because although often you speak of surgeons and doctors who do non-consensual experimentation, and we think of these Frankensteinian characters. But the reality is these have tended to be overachieving adepts who were stellar physicians. They were well-revered, well-respected within the profession in their time. And only people only knew of their work through their own bolderized versions of it. They wrote up these accounts in medical journals, but they never characterized them as abusive experimentation because it was accepted for them that you operated on slaves who couldn't say no.
Talk about Tuskegee, the Tuskegee experiment. Though you write about how it obscures all others, a lot of people don't even know about Tuskegee.
That's true. That's true. Tuskegee is the, you know, the icon of abusive experimentation of black people. But it's true. Many people still don't know what happened, and there are a lot of misconceptions floating about as well. So that's a really good question, Amy. What happened was that about 400 black men in Macon County, Alabama, with syphilis, who had been diagnosed with syphilis at least, were studied over a period of 40 years by the United States Public Health Service. There were 200 men who were not infected, who were held as a control group, also black men. Over the course of 40 years, these men were duped into thinking that they were in a treatment program, but they weren't. They were given pink pills, which, as it transpired, were simply aspirin. They were given spinal taps, which, as it transpired, were not for the good of their health or to monitor their health, but rather to ensure a supply of sera for the development of a syphilis test. So they were used over 40 years, even after the advent of penicillin. When penicillin was recognized as a cure, it was withheld from these men.
And this was between what was a 40-year span?
1932 to 1972.
How many people knew about this at the time? How did it stop?
Hundreds of people knew about it because there were regular reports in the medical journals, and it was actually presented at an American Medical Association meeting in 1965. There were also numerous meetings of governmental agencies where they periodically would ask, should we continue the experiment or not? And the decision was always yes. We should continue the experiment. It's worth noting that the Surgeon General, Thomas Perrin, had taken on syphilis eradication as his mission. And yet, when penicillin was devised and he had the cure, he made the decision to continue the experiment because he said they represent an opportunity that will never come again.
What happened to the untreated men?
The untreated men, as you can well imagine, many of them died horrible deaths. You know, they were not only infected with syphilis, it was untreated, but these were also very poor men, sharecroppers. Their median income was a dollar a day, but being sharecroppers, they rarely saw any money. And they were debilitated beyond their years by syphilis and the prostrating labor. And so many of them died, you know, very bad deaths from syphilis. They suffered, the secondary stage of syphilis is very painful. It constitutes running sores, you know, heart abnormalities. And the last stage of syphilis is devastating, neurologically devastating. Not everyone progresses to the last stage, you know, fortunately. But you can't predict who will and who won't, so everyone should be treated.
Now, this 40-year period obviously spanned both Democratic and Republican administrations in charge of the United States Public Health Service. Did your research uncover anybody who actually raised alarm and questioned, I mean, not just asked should we continue it, but mm-hmm. actually tried to oppose a call for an end to this experimentation?
Two people. One was Dr. Irvin Schatz of Detroit, who wrote a letter to the Public Health Service after they published an article in a premier medical journal. And he said, I'm shocked and astonished that you are permitting these men to continue dying of a treatable disease. And there is a note attached to his letter by a physician who writes, I'm not going to answer this. And indeed, they didn't. The other person was Peter Buxton, and he was a young Polish immigrant who was responsible for ending the study because he was a low-level interviewer with the Public Health Service, and he was shocked when he discovered it. He questioned it. At the risk of his job, he could easily have been dismissed even for questioning it. And what I found really chilling is the fact that he would write these letters, very brave of him, protesting it. And after he wrote enough of them, these doctors called him into a room where they all sort of sat arrayed against him, very intimidating, and lectured him, explaining to him the scientific process and why they were right to do this. Well, Buxton didn't agree. He left the PHS, went to law school, and through his entire three years of law school, kept writing these letters. And when he got no response, when they gave him the same silent treatment Dr. Schatz had gotten, he called a journalist friend. And the AP ran the story, and the rest is history.
And are there any of the doctors who are involved in these experiments who are still practicing?
Unfortunately, none of them... None of the doctors who conducted the experiment are alive. I say unfortunately, because I think one of the great tragedies of the study is that the miscreants have gone unpunished. I say their names whenever I can, because you never read of the names of the people who were the architects of the study. It was Thomas Morell, O.C. Wenger. These men and Thomas Perrin, others like them, perpetuated the study. And yet there's been, you know, no... They were never accused of anything. Nothing castigated them. They apparently, obviously, have gotten off scot-free. And blame has been deflected on a nurse, you know, who was arguably the lowest person on the medical totem pole. And she's been made, Eunice Rivers had been made to bear the brunt of this study, when actually the people who devised it were never challenged.
When Clinton was president, he apologized to the survivors?
Yes.
Were there any reparations?
There weren't reparations as such, but something very important did come out of the study materially, and that was the establishment of the National Center of Bioethics at Tuskegee University. That's very important because this is a bioethics center staffed and run by black people at a historically black university. And they have been working very hard to, number one, educate people about the real legacy of Tuskegee, and also involve African-Americans in bioethics and specifically in the medical research process. So that was a very, very important result.
We're talking to Harriet Washington, who's written the book Medical Apartheid, The Dark History of Medical Experimentation on Black Americans from Colonial Times to the Present. Can you talk about Holmesburg Prison? And I ask about this because there's this latest news about a federal panel talking about loosening regulations around experimentation on prisoners. So if you could address both.
Sure. I'm actually going to start with the federal panel, which just a few months ago made a recommendation that prisons, which have been mostly closed to research since the 1970s, be reopened. This is a very bad decision, and although it's not legally binding, all indications are that the government is going to take this recommendation, reopen prisons. And the reason why this is a problem is if you look at the history of research in prisons, it's been the site of the worst abuses, very troubled. There were experimental agents administered, men were crippled, killed, there were mind control experiments. And the worst thing about it is that the concept of consent in a prison is very problematic. The coercive nature of prison makes it very difficult for a prisoner to say no.
You also indicate that obviously that a lot of this experimentation has continued. You had the one example in one chapter of a of a gentleman, Caspar Yagan, a 68-year-old retired auto mechanic and who disappeared in 1977.
Right.
And could you talk about that?
Yeah, that case was quite chilling because that's where I talk about the use of blacks for anatomical dissection. When Yagan disappeared, his family sought, you know, searched from high and low, and they called the hospitals repeatedly and were told he wasn't there. But he turned up to be on a laboratory slab about to undergo dissection. He had died and was being dissected. And this indicates that black people have been used much more often for anatomical dissection against their will.
Where? What
everywhere,
laboratory?
Everywhere.
Slab, though, in this case of this man?
Oh, this was interesting. Howard Medical School, which is a predominantly African-American school. Another theme of the book, which
is... How did they find him? How did they know this was the man?
Well, it turns out he was the only unidentified patient in the hospital during the time his family was told he wasn't there. And the larger issue is that blacks are more likely to be have their bodies taken for dissection. It's a result of a long pattern of co-opting the bodies of slaves and then later of poor blacks. That's less flagrant now, but still exists. So there's a disparity.
So in other words, hospitals might be in the practice of if there's an unidentified patient who dies, then using those bodies for dissection without thinking, well, this person belongs to some family. Some family is looking for them, rather than wait and see if they can be identified and use them for
experimentation. Yeah, and the system is actually set up to make people who are certain people at higher risk. Because the system actually says that if a patient dies in a hospital and no one comes to claim the body, it goes to the coroner's office, and the coroner has the option of making the body available for dissection. Well, think about who dies without someone coming to claim the body. Poor people, homeless people, who are more likely to be black or Hispanic.
I want to go back to Holmesburg Prison, because you're talking about two kinds of experimentation there. There was the experimentation that you write about where prisoners are injected with staphylococcus and Neisseria, herpes, other viruses. Also, the doctor in charge, Dr. Kligman, was also doing work for cosmetics companies?
That's right. Dr. Albert Kligman made a fortune doing this kind of work for pharmaceutical companies and then also became rich working for the government. So, yes, he actually was a dermatologist who went way beyond his field to inject men at the behest of pharmaceutical companies with dangerous chemicals.
And cosmetics.
And cosmetics.
So they'd make a kind of checkerboard, another book written, Acres of Skin.
By Alan Hornblum, very good book.
Very interesting book where the cover is a picture of a checkerboard of where they test different parts of the back of a man with different chemicals to see how they would react.
Exactly.
And they would walk around as these checkerboards.
Right. And in fact, the prison guard said when he went to the beach in the area, he could tell who'd been in the prison by looking at the patterns on their backs.
And so what's come of this?
Well, some of the survivors are still around and are suing. They're trying to sue the university and Dr. Kligman. But Dr. Kligman himself has been honored, has never, you know, been castigated or sued. And so far, they've been unsuccessful in their suit. Hornblum is actually helping them a great deal. You know, it's wonderful of him.
Yeah, we interviewed him, and we'll link on this broadcast to the show with the survivors of those tests at Holmesburg.
What about the issue of sterilization? I know, obviously, in Puerto Rico throughout the 1940s and 50s, there was a massive sterilization campaign. But what about the sterilization of African-American women?
Oh, it's very troublesome. African-Americans have been more likely to be sterilized during the eugenics period, but even more recently, African-American women constitute 85% of the women who are forced to undergo Norplant implantation for abusing their children.
And explain what Norplant is.
Norplant is a contraceptive, no longer on the market, but it's implanted in the woman's arm, and it confers sterility for 5 years, at least. All kinds of medical problems resulted, though, you know, from depression to weight gain to physical problems, and it was taken from the market eventually.
And who was experimented on with it?
Oh, black women, black girls in the Baltimore school system. Baltimore is 82% black. So these girls were also like 95% black.
Did they understand that they were part of an experiment?
No, it wasn't presented as an experiment. It was presented as a Philadelphia Inquirer said, a way to reduce the underclass, a solution to the teenage pregnancy problem. But it's very short-sighted. Teenage pregnancy has its roots in, you know, a wide variety of medical and social issues, and an implanted capsule is not going to cure it.
You also talk about experiments or investigations done on black adolescents who have behavior problems.
Right, who are alleged to have behavior problems, right. Yeah. And also on black boys, specifically, who they think might have a genetic predisposition to violence. But there's no rationale for only looking at black boys. If you're looking at predisposition for violence, you should be looking at all boys. And most American boys, of course, are white. But it's black boys who've been singled out for these very dangerous experiments, such as a fenfluramine experiment that took place right here in New York City between 1992 and 1997.
What was that about?
They took, let's see, from 110 to 36 black boys and gave them fenfluramine, which is half of that Fen-Phen drug that was taken off the market because it was cardiotoxic, caused heart problems. They gave it to these boys in an attempt to see whether they would show some inclination toward violence. And they found the boys, because the boys were the younger brothers of children already in the juvenile justice system. So that was coercive in itself. They used the juvenile justice system to identify boys. And again, the protocol, which I read, only indicates black boys are eligible. White boys were not eligible.
We're talking to Harriet Washington, author of Medical Apartheid. We'll be back with her in a minute. Jackson singing We Shall Overcome. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. We're broadcasting on over 500 stations around the country, on Pacifica and NPR stations, low-power FM, college and community radio stations, on PBS and public access TV stations, as well as on both TV satellite networks, on Dish Network Channel 9415 Free Speech TV, 9410 Link TV, and on DirecTV Channel 375. And we're video and audio podcasting at democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Juan.
Yes, I'd like to ask you again about some of these experiments on children. There was a Mississippi neurosurgeon that you write about, Orlando J. Andy, who was doing this experimentation in the 60s and 1970s.
Yes. Oh, very, very troubling experimentation. Essentially, what he was doing was he was taking institutionalized young black boys and cutting out parts of their brain. Now, his rationale for doing that was that they had, quote-unquote, behavior problems. But there's no psychologist report. Andy was not a psychologist, but a neurologist. There was no indication that they had behavioral problems. And if you consider that during this period in the Deep South, the very narrow range of acceptable behaviors for black boys, you know, you think about the Emmett Till case, which has renewed interest now, he was murdered for whistling at a white woman. So what did these boys do to justify Andy taking out parts of their brain? The most chilling aspect of this is that Andy is revered as a hero. His university is very proud of his work.
His university is?
University of Mississippi. And if you look at the medical literature, you won't find any indication that he did anything untoward.
And you're saying he was conducting brain surgery on children that were otherwise not ill?
I'll say that he was conducting brain surgery on children for which there was no evidence of illness. No one offered any evidence except his own statement that the boys had a behavior problem. And, you know, what's a behavior problem? Most six-year-old boys are very annoying at some point, if not permanently, you know. So why were these young boys treated this way?
And what was the involvement of the parents of these children? Or you're saying they were mostly institutionalized.
Right, which means the parents are removed from the equation. And that's a problem with black children. They're much more likely to have their parents removed from the informed consent equation. They're more likely to be institutionalized than white children.
We're talking to Harriet Washington, who's written Medical Apartheid, and you also have recommendations. Talking about the issue of African-American suspicion of the medical system and the practice of experimentation moving from the United States to developing countries, to Africa.
Right. Well, in terms of African-American suspicions, there are two parts to that. There's also the untrustworthiness of the system. In terms of the importation of exportation research to Africa, highly problematic. A lot of the abuse in African-Americans has dissipated. But it's being, that kind of research is being conducted in Africa, where people in the same situation, they don't have rights, they don't have access to medical care otherwise, and Africa's being treated as a laboratory of the West by Western researchers. Very troublesome.
You mentioned specifically the easy measles vaccine?
Yeah, that's a very good example. A vaccine that killed hundreds of children in Brazil and Africa was then used in Los Angeles on parents who had no idea that the vaccine was experimental. They were only told that their children were being vaccinated.
The Edmonton Zagreb,
yeah. Named after the two cities where it was perfected.
Your recommendations?
My recommendations, first of all, are I'm very concerned about the erosion of informed consent in this country. We have more and more laws that are watering down informed consent. In 1996, the government decided that emergency room patients could be used in experiments without their consent. And I say we have to stop this here and abroad. We also have to institute a program of patient education. People go into medical research with no idea of what their rights are and how to protect themselves. Researchers are trained, as I was when I was at Harvard Medical School, and we have to extend the same advantage to subjects and patients. And finally, African Americans have got to take charge of this issue. We can't afford to avoid medical research now. It's too much part of treatment. But we have to learn to protect ourselves. So we have to make this an issue, as we have done with AIDS and environmental racism, and begin educating ourselves and militating for better treatment.
And what about the issue of payment for being part of an experiment?
Well, I always find that problematic because researchers, and they may sincerely believe this, say that it's not payment, but just like an indication of goodwill. $100 is an indication of goodwill if you're a wealthy professor at Harvard Medical School. But if you're a poor woman living in Washington Heights, $100 can be an inducement. So I am against payment. I'm much more in favor of educating people.
And what about some of these institutions that have participated in some of these horrific experiments in the past, in terms of them coming forth, apologizing, being held accountable for what they've done in the past?
Personally, apology sounds good, but I'm not a great fan of it because I think that in one sense it allows you to duck responsibility. I would rather than a verbal statement, I would much rather see, you know, material resources applied toward educating and assisting African Americans in medical research.
Well, I want to thank you very much for being with us and for doing this remarkable historical and contemporary look at experimentation on African Americans. The book is called Medical Apartheid, The Dark History of Medical Experimentation on Black Americans from Colonial Times to the Present. The author is Harriet Washington, was an ethics fellow at Harvard Law School, also was a fellow at Stanford University, is now a visiting scholar at DePaul University School of Law, wrote for USA Today. And Medical Apartheid is her book. We will link to it at democracynow.org. As we move now to our last segment, with a look at how illness is used, manipulated, and in some instances created by pharmaceutical companies to make greater profits. This is an excerpt of a new documentary called Big Bucks, Big Pharma: Marketing Disease and Pushing Drugs. It was produced by the Media Education Foundation. I narrated it.
blood pressure may have gone from normal to high overnight. New government guidelines mean millions need a checkup. Do you?
At the same time that drug advertising is pushing people to their doctors, experts are busy redefining what it means to be sick.
All you have to do is change the definition of high blood pressure, and you can increase that market by tens of millions of people, or change the definition of high cholesterol.
If you didn't have a cholesterol problem yesterday, you may have one now.
The new guidelines call for a huge boost in use of cholesterol-lowering drugs known as statins. The new numbers mean millions of Americans may be taking statin drugs for the rest of their lives.
In some cases, it is a question of, hey, more people are getting treated for this, and this is great. In some cases, even more people should get treated, probably. But what's always muddying the waters here is that a major source of information to consumers and to doctors alike is the industry that stands to profit from these medicines.
The guidelines were written by 9 experts on cholesterol. The National Institutes of Health, which sponsored the report, now says 6 of them have financial ties, such as speaking fees, research grants, or other funds with drug companies which make the most widely used medications.
In recent years, Big Pharma has begun promoting more than just its treatments and products. Drug companies now increasingly advertise health conditions themselves. As a result, Big Pharma normalizes even the most obscure health disorders and presents them as common.
It's frustrating. Just when you're ready to relax, that's when it happens. The urge to move, along with uncomfortable sensations in your legs. They're hard to describe, but they can even keep you from getting to sleep. You feel the urgent need to get up and move, just to get some relief. There's a name for it. Restless leg syndrome. And if you have it, you're among the nearly 1 in 10 U.S. adults who do. Want to know more? Visit restlesslegs.com or talk to your doctor.
Of all the things that industry does, this is probably the one thing that I think could be labeled as evil, that in order to make a profit, you're disease-mongering, in other words, making population, medicalizing something that is just really part of everyday life.
You often feel distracted, disorganized, restless, unable to finish things. Like the channel keeps changing in your mind and you can't control the remote.
You guys have any thoughts?
If you felt these symptoms your whole life, you may have adult ADD.
So in other words, a person who is not yet a patient, who is actually feeling quite good, sits down to watch the evening news, and after seeing a few commercials, says to him or herself, you know, I'm not quite as healthy as I thought.
Got to remember that appointment tomorrow. Did I send the car payment? What made me volunteer for that assignment?
Introducing Lunesta, a sleep aid that can give you and your restless mind the sleep you need.
You have this huge phenomenon then, a huge increase in prescriptions, and there's this debate about what is this problem? You know, has it always been around? Is it a problem of behavior? Is it really a biomedical problem?
What's happened now is you've taken a healthy person and medicalized something that was not medical, and this person may very soon end up on prescription medication.
At work, I'm tense about stuff at home. At home, I'm tense about stuff at work.
If you're one of the millions of people who live with uncontrollable worry, anxiety, and several of these symptoms for 6 months or more, you could be suffering from generalized anxiety disorder and a chemical imbalance.
Because patent life can be extended if new indications are approved, companies are constantly searching for new diseases to treat with old drugs. Antidepressants of the Prozac variety, or SSRIs, are a good example of this practice. Originally approved for major depressive disorder, these drugs are now prescribed for a variety of mood and anxiety disorders. Each new indication approved promises increased profits and must therefore be promoted heavily to the public. A striking example is how Paxil was revitalized as a treatment for social anxiety disorder. Its company hired a public relations firm to frame this condition as a major and common medical problem, and the firm launched a multifaceted campaign that moved beyond advertising to get stories about social anxiety disorder placed in print media and on television.
This morning, we begin a special two-part series on social anxiety disorder. Many of us have suffered from shyness or fear of social situations at some point in our lives. But for millions of Americans, their anxiety can be debilitating.
Paxil's award-winning product director was quoted as saying,
Every marketer's dream is to find an unidentified or unknown market and develop it. That's what we were able to do with social anxiety disorder.
What it is. What it feels like. What it is. What it feels like. What it is. We know what social anxiety can feel like, and Paxil can help.
When people begin to critique these advertisements and these campaigns, I think it's a little easy to actually forget about the people who do suffer from social anxiety disorder, who suffer from major depression, who suffer from post-traumatic stress disorders. You know, there are people who suffer from these conditions and whose lives are radically transformed by the medications. And I think that it's actually important to remember that. That doesn't mean that at the same time we're not sort of creating a culture of the worried well. People who might have this problem are sort of suddenly concerned that they have this problem.
Over 10 million Americans suffer. Do you?
If we take shyness, which is probably a part of the personality of most of us, in some situations, you know, it's an appealing part of people, it's part of their personality. And we turn it into a new entity and we call it social anxiety disorder. Now you've increased the size of the market. Now you can go out and you can advertise Paxil for social anxiety disorder, for somebody being shy.
The Paxil CR ad reads to me a little bit like medicalizing normal experience.
If you are one of the many who suffer from overwhelming anxiety and intense fear of social situations with unfamiliar people, now there's Paxil CR. Paxil CR helps relieve the symptoms of social anxiety disorder all day, so the real you can come through.
You have people who look mostly comfortable, but you know they're a little uncomfortable in a social setting, and we're turning that into a condition that needs significant treatment. You know, the SSRIs have a million side effects. They're not clean drugs. And to suggest that if you have a tough time going into a meeting and introducing yourself to people, you should be on an SSRI, I think is problematic.
We are going to take a closer look tonight at the possible link between antidepressants and suicide.
The other disturbing aspect of this class of antidepressants was the fact that these drugs were being prescribed to a large number of children.
About 1 million children under 18 take such drugs now, with doctors writing three times as many prescriptions as they did a decade ago.
And we don't know if the drugs were being used appropriately, if they were being used in children with major depressive disorder, or they were being used on a 12 or a 14-year-old boy that didn't make the football or the basketball team and he felt sad.
So you have this kind of
big bucks, big pharma, marketing disease and pushing drugs. It was produced by the Media Education Foundation, and that does it for our broadcast. By the way, coming up as we continue our Breaking the Sound Barrier tour, on February 10th, I'll be in Melbourne, Florida, as we celebrate WFIT at the Gleason Performing Arts Center at Florida Institute of Technology. You can go to our website at democracynow.org to get on more information. And also, our headlines, we are doing them in Spanish and putting them on our website at democracynow.org, and any radio station in this country and around the world can pick them up, as more than 100 stations are. As we continue as the largest public media collaboration in the country, you can also get our daily digest, our daily headlines, and the stories that we're pursuing by going to our website and signing up at democracynow.org. Also, our transcripts, full transcripts of every broadcast are there, including, of course, today's, our interview with Harriet Washington, author of Medical Apartheid. So you can go there and check it out. And also, finally, we are looking for flat-screen TVs, if you want to help us out, at democracynow.org. If you got one for the holidays, a better one that still your other one was working, think about us. That does it for the show. Democracy Now! Was produced by Mike Burke, Sharif Abdo-Kadous, John Hamilton, Elizabeth Press, Yoruba Richin, Aaron Mate, Lee Burek, Jen Youths, Anna Noguera. Mike DeFilippo and Miguel Noguera are our engineers. Special thanks also to Megan Whitney, Rebecca Silver, Angela Alston, Uri Galed, Peter Yoon, Jerome Bourgeois, Julian O'Connor, Samantha Chamblee. I'm Amy Goodman, Juan Gonzalez. Thanks for joining.